thank you very much. And I know that this is not the National Center for Healthcare and Public Housing, nor is it July 13th. So I apologize that I did not change the title on this slide, but I think it's a good segue into what I'm going to talk about today. The Association of Clinicians for the Underserved is a national nonprofit organization whose mission is to do trainings with healthcare providers who work in the community on a variety of subjects. And when we say healthcare providers, it's all of us. It's not just the doctors and the nurses. It's the community health worker. It's the social worker. It's the health educator. We really like to get the administrators and the secretarial staff on board with what the issues are so that we can present healthcare as a team. And one of the things that we've been doing a lot of is training with healthcare providers who provide care to the residents of public housing. And that's why this slide says what it is, and I apologize that I didn't change it. I do have a couple things I want to pass out, and if you can just leave them in the back of the room, I can pick it up on the way out. One is we are starting a new section of our website on tools for tobacco cessation for clinicians, and if you want to get information when that goes live, you can sign up here, and Joyce will pass it out. And the other is we do trainings at CMEs for doctors and nurses and PAs on tobacco cessation and on specifically on asthma issues, because that's where our funding comes from. So I'm passing information out about that as well. And let me see if I know how to go to the next slide here. Try that. And while Joyce is doing that for me, I'll just keep talking because I'd like to stick to my 15 minutes. And this is a very short summary of a training that we do with healthcare providers about smoking cessation and public housing. And the first thing that I'm supposed to tell you all is that I have no relations to disclose and that, thank you, and that this project has been funded by the US EPA. And the reason why we got into this is I like to steal a line from the American Lung Association, which is, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. And again, our funding is specifically around asthma and asthma triggers. And so to that extent, we look at all the reasons why people should stop smoking and how clinicians can get folks to stop smoking, but specifically in how it relates to asthma. And so when we work with our healthcare providers, we talk about the asthma statistics, that about 24.6 million people in this country have asthma. That means the prevalence is a little over 8%. But in public housing, in 4 out of 10 public housing units, so about 40%, there's at least one person diagnosed with asthma. So that doesn't mean that 40% of the people live in public housing have asthma. It's probably more than that, but it's at least in 40% of the units. There's somebody with asthma. And I know that the nice thing about being at the APHA is that we all know that we are preaching to the choir here. But we really like to hit home why are all the reasons that people should stop smoking. Because unfortunately, I think what happens with clinical staff who work with the underserved is like, oh yeah, he smokes. Oh yeah, he smokes. You know, I can fix the diabetes and hypertension because there are medications for that. And I can get a number. I can put a blood pressure cuff on and I can get a number of what the blood pressure is. Or I can do my labs and see how the diabetes is. But because smoking is such a serious and difficult addiction to break, many providers say, I've given up. I've stopped talking about smoking. So we like to remind them that 53,000 people die annually from smoking. And that laws mandating smoke-free indoor air are widespread. And I think you'll hear about some of that today. But private homes are considered beyond the reach of regulation. And then we kind of step back because many of us, again, being the clinical situation, we sort of forget the specifics. And we remind them that there's at least 250 poisonous gases, chemicals, metals that are in cigarettes. And we talk about the number that are known carcinogens. And we refer to some studies that show people are exposed to second and third hand smoke, how much of the chemicals that are in smoking are in their bloodstream. So it's really exciting to think that we've gone from a time in probably, at least in my lifetime, and maybe the lifetimes of some of you, where we had a president who promoted smoking, gave cigarettes to his friends for Christmas, or at least advertised cigarettes, to a situation now where we would like to believe that our president has stopped smoking, and that's been hailed as something that his wife and the rest of us are definitely very proud of. About 35% of Medicaid enrollees smoke, and that's compared to about 20% of the adult population as a whole. And so in public housing, we're assuming that most of these people are actually Medicaid enrollees. And some of the new legislation by the federal government says that the Medicaid will give matching funds for quit lines to Medicaid beneficiaries, and that smoking cessation programs will be covered for pregnant women. So again, we've gone from a president who advertises smoking to a president who's come out publicly that he stopped smoking to a government that is going to put all these incredible warning labels on cigarettes. And I do live in Washington, D.C., and one of the nice things about living in Washington, D.C. is, you know, your neighbors are people who work in high-powered places in the government, and you get an inside story on a lot of things. So I have a neighbor who used to be an attorney at Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and now he is at the FDA Center for Tobacco Policy. And our kids went trick-or-treating last night, and he was saying that they're really working on these because some people want to say smoking causes blindness, or smoking causes Alzheimer's, or smoking causes tooth decay, and where do you stop? Because we know that smoking causes all these things. And I think it's been a historic victory for children and for health in America that the Food and Drug Administration will now regulating tobacco, and this will be on the tobacco products. And one of the things that I was surprised to find out recently in a training I did with healthcare providers in Hawaii, which I wish I could say I did it in Hawaii, it was a webinar, was that 60% of middle schoolers in Hawaii are smoking. So we know that kids are starting to smoke at a very young age. And with respect to housing, I think the more interesting work is done by somebody who I'm sure is somewhere at this conference and maybe even in this room. I've never met him, I've heard him on webinars. And that's Dr. Winnikoff, who's the pediatrician who's written a lot about smoking and smoking cessation in public housing and really being on the vanguard of this issue of whether it is something that should be banned altogether or if it's specifically because it's your own home, you know, what are the rights of people in their own home. And he says that smoke doesn't know how to stop at the door and gives some really interesting statistics on children and their exposure to second and third hand smoke. But in addition to that, he's really looked at the consumer demand by all the residents of smoking cessation. And just recently, the state of Maine passed a law that by January 2012, all of their public housing units will be smoke-free. And there was a webinar I just listened to on that where they talked about, I'm pretty sure it was like 70 or 75% of the residents of public housing said that they wanted it to be smoke-free. In addition to the health issues and the consumer demand, something that we have on our side here is the fact that the insurance companies that insure the public housing units, they don't want smoking in the home because it increases the chance of fire. And as also some of the owners of these units and the organizations that own these public housing units are concerned about the issues around cleaning the units. I think something else that Winnikoff said is if we're going to protect the bartenders and restaurants, if we're going to protect healthy kids, healthy adults who go to work and enjoy a smoke-free workplace, we better protect infants, children, pregnant women, and elderly women, elderly people who live in public housing. So again, I think this is you're a well-informed audience, and speaking at APHA is always like being in a room with all your best friends. But we used to only talk about first-hand smoke, and that was, you know, if you were the actual smoker, and then second-hand smoke, if somebody was smoking in the home. And now we're really looking at third-hand smoke, and that's smoke that somebody brings home on their clothes, and smoke that moves along in air ducts, cracks in the walls and floors, elevator shafts, along plumbing and electrical lines. And so I think that in talking about public housing or any large housing unit, you may be very, very far away from an actual smoker. There may not even be a smoker in your home, but you may be getting some exposure to smoke. In July of 2009, the federal government put out a regulation that encouraged public housing authorities to implement non-smoking policies. It was not a mandate. They didn't have to do this, but they've asked for smoking public housing units to at least have a designated area, that some new public housing units should just be should have some smoke-free areas. And many of the places have gone ahead with this, and that includes, I mentioned earlier, Boston as well as Maine. So the debate really continues whether or not this is a right that people have in their home to smoke, or if the public's good is for the public good, if there should be smoking cessation in public housing. I think we're going to see more and more public housing authorities move in this direction. So what we really hit home with the clinicians is we break down, again, issues of smoking, because I know as a nurse practitioner, I got very little training in my professional training on addiction in general, and what do these things mean, and how we get somebody off, and how to treat smoking as a chronic disease, and bringing it up at every visit. And I think the important thing to hit on with clinicians, and maybe there's some clinicians in the room, is that anybody who's using electronic health record knows that as part of meaningful use, we spend government money for making sure we're using electronic health records appropriately, we have to document public smoking with all of our residents. I only have a few minutes left, so I just wanted to really quickly talk about, we know that there's barriers to do talk about cessation in public housing. What we've been able to talk to clinicians about is for them to understand what are issues around housing, safe housing, how to access medications for smoking cessation cheaply, because they're very expensive. Chantix is incredibly expensive. Some programs don't cover it. How to access the clinic to be part of a medical home. What are issues around health literacy, language, and culture that may come into play in terms of doing smoking cessation? For example, doing training in a language that people understand would be more beneficial than doing it in English if you're working with a largely non-English speaking audience. And then we give them some basic background on smoking cessation, and I'm not going to go through all that in detail, other than to say that we really emphasize the healthcare team, and that the clinician who is burnt out on talking about smoking cessation probably can't do it alone. So we talk about the integration of the community health worker, who again may be able to provide the information in a language and at a level and with a solidarity that has more entree into the community, as well as doing group visits, which is really cost effective. If you know, if they want to have the doc or the nurse or somebody in there, you know, you can be in there for part of it. There is coding that is available to do that to get reimbursement, but we talk about that as something that every community health center should have, as well as mentioned, education in the language and a level that people understand. And then lastly, we bring in the pharmacists as a key player. We really believe that the pharmacist can provide a lot of education and a lot of support to the patient. Again, expanding the healthcare team so it all doesn't fall on the primary care clinician. And then lastly, we talk about reimbursement issues, which is, when it comes down to it, what the clinical situation, they just want to know, how, am I getting paid to do this, or how much am I getting paid to do that? So I'm going to stop here because I have 15 minutes and I want to make sure that my colleagues have enough time. But I sent around that piece of paper, and so I'd be happy to talk more about this. Or if you work in organizations with healthcare providers, we'd be happy to talk about doing the training. And one last thing I have to say is, because I am local, I may run out of here before it's over. So I apologize. I have a family event I have to attend. Thank you.